You listen to 247 Real Talk. This is your host, Julian Perry. And it's a pleasure to be here with you again on another episode of Real Talk. I'll be discussing racism in America. I'll be right back. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of 247 Real Talk Podcast. It's my pleasure to be here with you. It is about 8:52 on Wednesday, May 18th. That's 8:52 p.m. And as I start recording this episode, I just got breaking news here on my phone that five people were shot, three critical, in a mass shooting in Philadelphia near Temple University. I pray that they recover, and I want to reach out to the entire nation to say stop the violence. You know, this is not the way to solve an issue that you have with someone. This is not the way to solve a political issue. The way that we solve these issues is to do what we do on this podcast and what so many other podcasts and TV shows are doing around the world. Having conversations, listening to each other, and then making changes that support each other. I felt compelled to record this episode on racism in America because it's something that's been in my mind for a while, and then being in New York and then this Buffalo shooting just sort of angered me, let me put it that way. This gentleman in the Buffalo shooting apparently wrote a 183-page, you want to call it manifesto, talking about the replacement ideology, which is, you know, supposedly black people, minorities replacing whites in their jobs and in their places in society. And I find it amazing that we have all these mechanisms in place that are trying to prevent cyber threats from Russia and around the world, and yet we allow social media to spew this nonsense all over the country and all over the globe, and for it to gain attention, for it to gain popularity, for those who seek to harbor hatred within themselves, or somehow that drives them. This particular incident, and if you see me looking down, it's because I wrote some notes here because I wanted to cover some points. So let's start about this shooting. This gentleman went to a black neighborhood, surveyed the neighborhood, planned the shooting at the supermarket, and had apparently planned to do more shootings had he not been caught. A year before this, he had written some story with his school about, or for his school, or for his teachers, and his story was about shooting up the school or something like that. He was given a mental health evaluation, which should, according to all these fabulous laws that, you know, we keep passing in New York State and all over the country, these gun laws that are actually a mirage, because all they do is punish law-abiding people, citizens more, and create this myth of government actually doing something about gun violence. So had they put this thing in place where if you have a mental health evaluation, there's supposed to be a trigger, and it's supposed to be an unique indicator that keeps you on the radar on databases, like, you know, when you go to buy a gun. Law enforcement, he fell off of law enforcement's radar, and the system of mental health checks and not buying a gun, none of that worked. So he went and he bought a gun legally. He went back to this store, and I don't know how many people saw it. I happened to see the video that he shot live of the shooting. I saw him drive up, get out of his car, shoot the first person, and then I think two or three other people in the parking lot, went into the store and started firing. It was, you couldn't miss the fact that as he was running through the store or moving through the store firing, he came across a white man who was on the ground taking cover. And the mic, you know, he startled him, and the white man was sort of, you know, in fear. And he looked down the white man and said, "Oh, sorry, sorry." He apologized to that white man on the ground for scaring him, because, of course, his intention was only to shoot black people. So the police arrive. Yapanti has a gun to his head. They talk him down, so to speak, and they arrest him. Now let's stop there. Let's just pause there and think for a second. So the police arrive, and there's a man with a gun who just shot 13 people and killed 10 of them. The police might not have known that those numbers at the time, but they know that he, from what they've been hearing, that this was the suspect, this was the perp, and this is, you know, he was involved in the shooting. They talk him down. And the first thing that crossed my mind is, when we hear about police shootings around the country of black men, I've heard of so many shootings of men, black men shot, retreating, running away, shot in the back, shot with no weapon. There was a couple of cases that I think were in the news last year, the year before, of officers who got convicted of shooting a black man running away in the back. If we can't see as a nation right now that no matter what we do, there is some stigma where when you're facing a black accused or perpetrator, your reaction is different. This whole talking down with a guy who just killed 13, or shot 13 people and killed 10, I would argue that the approach would have been different had it been a black man. But here we were, as minorities, the victim in this case. Now, before I go any further, I know I have a lot of supporters from every single ethnicity. And those who know me well know that my podcast, my episodes, my perspectives are simply real talk, the truth. This is not about me being racist because my friends who are white and very good friends and Hispanic and Asian and black, they'll tell you that's not me. What I'm speaking here is truth. I know there are many people who will want to listen to this and turn it into, oh, he's being prejudiced. No, I'm not. This is a reality of how people are treated. This is a reality of how minorities are treated. This is the ideology that's ingrained in so many people that has bubbled to the surface. So it is amazing that this was the treatment he was given, when many, many black men are 6 feet under, because they weren't given the same consideration. So let's talk about the racist struggle. You know, as I think about what's going on in our country now, I have different conversations with different people. I remember having a conversation one time when someone, a friend of mine who was white, Caucasian, said, you think it's about guns and stuff, but really, if you look at the black neighborhood, you can't say anything because it's black people shooting up black people. They're shooting themselves. And I have to admit that who I am a few years ago might have sort of been angered in the sense of I may have partially agreed with that statement, but I have a friend of mine I'm going to credit for this, and I'm going to say it out loud. I've mentioned his name before, Montagna Gladden, someone who I debate fiercely with, who reminds me of certain realities when even I tend to forget them in this mission that I'm involved in. If you look at the history of black people, we were enslaved. I'm not blaming here. I'm giving you the history because the point I'm making is a lot of what goes on in the black community, even the violence that goes on there now, is a result of conditioning, of what has been done to minorities. Remember, even when we talk about the Black Wall Street that they burned, when the black neighborhoods and the black people had wealth within their neighborhoods, and that was unacceptable to the white and the powerful. And so what has happened in all these neighborhoods is there's been a whole orchestrated effort that people want to deny, but this is the truth, it's been a whole effort to oppress minorities. You think about it for a second, and I've seen this in cities and in counties, even across the United States and across even here in New York. There's an effort, and there's a purposeful way of allocating, for instance, funds to schools for education. So you take someone, you put them in a neighborhood. You put no money in, you send the worst teachers there. You put no money into education, no money into their schools, no money into the opportunities. Meanwhile, you're pumping money into other areas that have people, with people that have money. You make sure that you create environments that have a certain ceiling for rents, which means that you sort of triage people into those neighborhoods because they're low income. And then the areas that you don't want what you will call this element there, these minorities there, you make the prices and the cost of living and the taxes way above anything they can afford. So it's automatic that the people of a certain status, socioeconomic status, and a certain race would end up in these neighborhoods. You put very little resources in the neighborhood. You stand up there as presidents and as lawmakers and talk about helping the country, but we know when we look at it where the resources actually go. So let's take one scenario here. You've got people living with no hope. And when I say no hope, it's not just that the issue of not putting resources into the neighborhood. It's the issue that has been more and more discussed these days about systemic racism, where people go out and look for jobs and can't get the certain jobs and sort of, again, I'll use the word triaged into a certain socioeconomic status. So they remain put, they remain where society wants them. Then you had this whole influx years ago of drugs into society, and poor black people didn't bring drugs into society. It's rich white people who brought drugs in. It's their drug of partying, and for those who get involved in that, it's their moneymaker. And so now you dangle these drugs in front of poor people, oppressed people, in two ways. One, you let them use it, you let them taste it. And when they use it and they know for a moment that all the things that oppress them, that worry them, for just that period of time, they get relief, they become addicted to it. And then you need to get your product out, so you go to the others who can't, who have been oppressed for so long, and you offer them a better life if they sell these drugs for you. And for the most part, they're selling the drugs right back into their community. And of course, more people see what you're doing, see it as the only way out. So you're able to recruit more and more sellers who now have to a certain extent, a finite area for their business. And so one starts to step on the toes of the other one in their customers or whatever, and now the war starts in between them for survival. You let that go on for years, and this is where we are. A lot of these killings and shootings have become inherently who these people are, generation after generation, us, black people. Because of the oppression, because the hope has been snatched away from them. Now, I'm going somewhere with this, and many of you who know me probably know where I'm going with this already. We have a situation where people, every few households in these neighborhoods, you have people who have someone in the family who wants to get out. Someone is born and or grows up with that drive, looks around their neighborhood. Maybe they even got shot. Something happened to them and they said, I want out. And you say to them, the only way out is to educate yourself to get a better job, to earn a better income, to be able to move yourself and maybe your family out of here. But when you've got someone who's oppressed, who is poor, and they want an education, they may be incredibly, and there's a lot of incredibly brilliant people. Even these drug dealers in our neighborhoods, amongst us, amongst black people who conduct this business, they conduct brilliant business. And of course, they get caught, many of them, but they conduct brilliant business because they have the minds. They're just not being used in the right way. If their minds were supported, if these people were uplifted and learned and given the opportunity to use that same mind to run businesses across this country, they would be great at it, and the wealthy and the rich would no longer be in the majority where wealth is concerned. So, and that's not wanted in this country. There's a need to have black people oppressed. Somebody's got to occupy that space in this world and in this country. So you've got this young kid that says, you know, I got to get out. He's brilliant. You got to go to school. How do I go to school? Well, there's only way you can do it is, you know, you apply to universities, you do you take the tests or whatever, you score high, but you can't get in. I can't afford it. And what do they say to you? Why don't you take out student loans? It's the only way out. So you go and you do exactly that. And you know, the way student loans work, they give you an allotment for every semester. And when you are in a bind, I mean, I remember when I was doing my undergrad, it was crazy that even that system was rigged against the students. I remember paying sometimes $150 for a textbook that the professor said you had to have. And that same professor used that book for the entire semester, maybe 3 or 4 times. I remember professors who assigned mandatory books. And when you looked at the books, there were photocopies of books written by that professor. And they made sure that was the book the students had to use, and the universities allowed it. So when you're in that predicament, you might have, let's say your tuition is, I'm just making numbers up now, let's say your tuition is $2,500 and the allotment of federal student loans you get for that semester is $4,000. Many people take the entire $4,000. They're not thinking about payback right then. They're thinking about, you know, I've got money to buy my books. I've got money to take the train to go back and forth from home, and from, you know, I've got money to get something to eat. So they rack up a lot more student loans than they actually use for education. But it's all part of the educational process. It's all part of the process that empowered them to be able to go. So they go through this system. They get their associates. They're told, especially for brilliant young black minorities, it's not enough. You can do better. They get a bachelor's. Some even get a master's. Now they've racked up $150,000, $180,000 in student loans. And remember the whole why this all started, because this was a way out for them. And the end of this journey, they're going to get this great job, and they're going to go back to the neighborhood. They're going to buy a home, or they're going to rent a better place. And they're going to go and get mommy and daddy and brother and sister and whomever they can. They're going to snatch them out of this environment of violence that has been poisoned by the rich and the wealthy in our society. But they only condemn it as black people doing these crimes. Nobody ever talks about how this happened, how this was created. It wasn't magic. It wasn't abracadabra. It was well orchestrated for the empowerment, for the benefit of the black person. So here we are. now they're going, now they reached a point where they're going for jobs, right? So you're going to find a job. Here comes systemic racism. You're searching for a job. You've got equal or better qualifications than the person next to you. But you get that letter. I've got many of them. Thank you so much for applying. We've decided to move forward with a different candidate. And you begin to believe it's you. You begin to believe that you're not good enough. Because how can this be? How can it be that I keep going to interviews after interviews, sending out 200 resumes, 300 resumes, and all I'm getting back is thank you? And the thing about it is, it really weighs on your self-esteem. It really comes down hard on you, the fact that you are trying so hard and it's not working. But you've got to live, right? So as this process goes on, 6 months later, the letters start coming. Oh, it's time to repay your student loans. Well, you can't. So you start to go to deferment. One deferment after another deferment after another deferment until you exhaust them. Meanwhile, you probably, you know, you might have found a job, something in an office where they want to pay you $30,000 or $40,000. And they have this wonderful way of saying, man, I wish we had a better position for you. You're so well qualified. You're overqualified. I know people who have removed education. I know minorities who have removed education, you know, levels of education from their resume to get a job. So because, you know, the minute they have, they put their master's on there and their PhDs on there, and employers see them, you know, figuring they need to be this high, we're not going to give you that job. And we're going to give you that line of overqualified. So we dumb ourselves down on the resume so that someone will give us a chance. Now you've exhausted the deferments. So now you go into forbearance. Year after year, you're fighting the same struggle. I've lived it. I know it. Meanwhile, you every day when you leave, you go back into the neighborhood you came from, or you go adjacent to that neighborhood because now you have a job, so maybe you can afford a couple more dollars in rent, or maybe you can't. So maybe if you can't, you're stuck. You know, you put on your affordable suit and tie, and every day you drag yourself for this job and you drag yourself back into this neighborhood, and you know, it's sort of an ironic picture when you see a young black man in a suit walking through what we will call the ghetto, the bad areas. You could see that the only thing that makes him fit there is the fact that he's an oppressed black person. Nothing shows of the effort he's made to get out. And this is a cycle that so many people face. Sometimes many of them go back to school, keep reaching higher, hoping that there is some. And this is funny because people have a way of telling you, and we've been taught this historically, the more educated you are, the better job you will get. That does not ring true for minorities. This isn't something that this country and this world and our leaders need to accept. I hate to see leaders talking about racism when they know nothing about it. I was listening, I think this past Sunday, I was driving home and I was listening to 1010 Winds. And this woman came on and she had, they were talking about student loans. And she came on, she had an opinion and she says, no, you should not forgive student loans because we will lose billions in revenue, the government. And I wanted to pull my truck over and scream. I was screaming at the radio. I could hear from her voice that she was likely Caucasian. I can't, you know, it sounded that way. We all have a sound. But this woman knows nothing about the history of how these two loans have become that way, about the oppression. You are telling me, and I heard today in the news again, that they're going to approve more aid for Ukraine. And I always reiterate, Ukraine is a horrible situation. What Putin is doing there is inhumane. It's genocide. And we as a human beings must have empathy for other human beings who are being bullied and killed and dumped into mass graves. But I will say it again to this President Biden, to all our leaders, to in New York, to Senator Schumer, to Nancy Pelosi, to whoever is in charge, charity begins at home. They gave an initial, I forgot how many billion to Ukraine. Then Biden went back to Congress and asked for 30-something billion. They said that wasn't enough. They gave 40 billion. And now I heard today they're going to give more. But you're telling me, and this woman is saying, that we cannot forgive student loans because it's going to cost us too much money in revenue. Yeah, go ahead and print money for foreign countries or people who you have empathy for. And make sure you crucify your own people who live, work here, who are part of the tapestry that makes up this nation. Her suggestion was, no, don't forgive anything. She said, make the first $10,000 of student debt interest free. And I said, I didn't get her name. I don't remember it, but if I did, I would say it here so everyone could hear it. This is a mad woman who is out of touch, okay? When it comes to knowledge of the oppression of minorities, she's an imbecile. It is impossible for someone to believe that you give $10,000 of zero interest loan, you are helping anybody. I'm going to read this little statistic I have here that says... I want to make sure I get it right. It says, the plan has always been to keep black people uneducated and working for the rich, powerful whites who first imported drugs into the neighborhoods. That was my thought. Then dangled hope by hiring black people to sell their drugs and even encouraging some to sell to their own people. They created a dependency. The statistic says that years after graduation, 48% of black students owe an average of 12.5% more than they borrowed. I didn't make that number up. That was a statistic I read somewhere when I was making up this document. 45 million Americans collectively owe over $1.7 trillion in student debt. And it's highly correlated with race. Now, that $1.7 trillion student debt is close to 9% of the GDP of the entire country. But that means nothing when you are giving money, printing and giving billions of dollars to Ukraine and to other countries in the world. 15% of U.S. adults have federal student loan debt. And women and people of color are disproportionately represented in these groups. About 24% of black adults say they have federal student loan debt, compared to 15% of Hispanic, 14% of white, and 11% of Asians. So you need to understand, you know, where this is going. And you need to understand that government plays a role, and they're ignoring their role. They are pretending to ignore their role. They pretend to be ignorant of the fact. I can't believe President Biden. You know, I had a lot of faith when President Biden was elected that he actually understood a little bit more about racism, what black people are facing in this country, about the relief we need, about the help that we need to step forward. Because without that help, we can't step forward. Without that help, we can't even begin to get level on the level playing field. I was looking at, I get these emails from newser.com. And you guys, you remember Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney was, or is, the Republican who went against Trump, and her party basically kicked her to the curb and stomped on her. I'm reading this part of this paragraph that says, Liz Cheney unleashed a scorching tweet against House GOP leaders on Monday, a group she had been among before her split with Donald Trump. The tweet comes in the wake of the mass shooting in Buffalo, which authorities have called a targeted assault by a white gunman on black victims. The House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. History has taught us that what begins with words ends in far worse. GOP leaders must renounce and reject these views and those who hold them. What she's saying to her own party is, you guys are enabling this. You guys are part of this. You guys are you know, you're hiding behind your words. You guys are the empowerment of why everyone else feels that they could do this and get away with it. Now, what I'm going to say next, I need you to listen to carefully, because I want you to get the full context of what I'm saying. It is always to be celebrated when someone, a minority, a black person, a Hispanic person, an Asian person, a minority, is chosen for a role that is unprecedented, that their race is an unprecedented choice in that position. We have the Justice Ketanji Brown, I believe her name is, the next Supreme Court judge that will go into office shortly, go into the court shortly. We have the first black press secretary for President Biden. And those people need to be celebrated simply because they were chosen for that role. And we must celebrate even the smallest of victories. But let me be clear, that's what those are, the smallest of victories. The fact of the matter is, I want you to take a bowl, a nice size bowl. I want you to fill it with salt. And then I want you to go get the black pepper shaker and just take it like, you know, they do in the restaurant, and top it with your fingers. And let a few sprinkles of black pepper fall into the salt. And that's what we look like in the professional world, in any world of choice where opportunity exists. If you want to talk about, you care about racism, President Biden, Senator Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, I'm calling them because these are the people who are in charge right now. It's their turn. You need to do something for the masses of people. I just read you statistics, and you can check it on your own. You know better than I do. These officials know better than I do. That giving relief to student loan debt is not just about allowing people to get off. It's not about that at all. It's about the fact that the majority of minorities who fought for a way to get up and to use their education, to put their skills forward, to be counted, to live a life, to provide for their families, to reach for what we call the American dream, there was a price to pay. And that price to pay was student loans that were supposed to get them to the place where they could earn enough to repay them and still live. Meantime, we got places like, what would you have, Trump University, the one that was, and many more like that, that were disbanded. All these schools that get federal student loans and have no obligation to even provide a decent education to their students. Now, even if you take that degree, to some employers, they look at you and laugh like if it's a menu from McDonald's. Why is it that when people are in a powerful, rich country like ours, when your people are educated here and turn around and are fighting for a position to be a part of this society to help America continue to be great, that you pounce on them and that you oppress them. You know, the consequences for not paying student loans are deadly to someone's life. I've seen people on Wall Street, rich white people on Wall Street, when the market crashed, they jumped out of windows and killed themselves because they couldn't take it. They couldn't take the loss. Imagine how a black person feels who scrapes and crawls to get to the point where they can, maybe they have to share it with two or three people in the household to pay a mortgage, to have a home, to come home and say, this little space is ours. Only to get to the point where they have to sell that home and move out because they can't pay that mortgage anymore, because all of a sudden they can't get a good job. The establishment, I'm going to call them the government, the establishment, have already admitted 10 times over that they recognize that there's not only is systemic racism, but systemic racism has been an issue for years and years and years and decades. And if you know this, and if you can acknowledge what people went through, if you can acknowledge the fact that black people did not get the jobs, that the minorities did not get the jobs, then you also have to acknowledge that you never gave them the opportunity to pay back the loans. And in the meantime, they're racking up interest in forbearance and deferments. And they're now at a place where they can't afford to pay them without completely destroying their lives. Life is short. People live to 90 years, some people live to 100 years. Even someone who lives to, my father is just turned 90 years old in January. And he continues to be healthy and God bless him. But even at his age, he would tell you life is short. So when you have the opportunity as a government, as a people, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, I don't care who you are, to unite and do something for millions of people that will move their lives away from disaster to hope, and you play a game with it, and you, Mr. Biden, as president, scratching your head saying, I don't think I'm going to forgive $50,000, but I have to come up with something. What you have to come up with is the right thing. No one's going to call you righteous. Your legacy is not going to be righteous if you squander this opportunity. Not only putting people back into oppression, but leaving it to the next leader for us to start this conversation again. There have been a lot of missteps in this particular administration. I'm not going to go back to them. I've spoken about them on other episodes. But this is one thing that they have the opportunity to do right. I personally wrote Senator Schumer a letter. I'm giving him a little bit of time. I haven't got a response, but I'm going to write it again. Whether I keep sending the same letter or keep writing, you know, depending on what's going on, writing different letters. And then the campaign is going to continue to the next person and the next person. I don't know how far I will get, but I think I can get pretty far, especially if I'm not alone. Especially if all of you out there recognize that rather than struggle your entire lives to pay off these student loans and deprive yourself of part of life and a part of America, deprive yourself of even being able to get into your car and drive across this great nation and say, I've seen California from New York, I've seen Nebraska, I've seen, you know, Colorado. Even that, people can never, some people have never left the state they were born in. Because opportunities just seem to elude them. And then they're stuck in these neighborhoods, like I said, and next thing you know, we are burying them. This whole gun violence thing that's going on in the black neighborhoods is not black people being foolish or angry. It is conditioned behavior. It is a response to years of oppression and years of stolen hope. I am happy for the few people that our president has helped, minorities, black, Hispanic, whatever. But I'm not going to be fooled by the political capital that they're trying to gain by saying to the nation, hey, I nominated the first black woman to the Supreme Court. Hey, I nominated the first black press secretary. I want you to say, hey, I freed millions of black people from oppression, from the oppression of student loans. I recognize that this is one big factor that they have been the unfortunate recipients of, and the only reason they have collected, or only reason they have been subjected to these student loans is because it was an effort to climb and crawl their way out of an oppressive situation. They were willing to work, willing to study, willing to do what it takes to get to the next level. Not born into generation after generation of wealth that just continues on and never ends. The brilliance, if you look through history, and that's another thing, I'll do an episode on that one day. Now, I'll do all the research because I've seen a lot of it, of how many things in this world, in this country, that we take for granted and use every day were actually designed by, created by, thought of by black people, by minorities. They don't get the recognition. And here we come to this guy in Buffalo who thinks that this theory of replacement, who are we going to replace? We can't afford to replace anybody. We have too much debt and too much oppression and too many struggles ahead of us to be called replacements. We don't walk into some place that where we can make an incredible salary and get the job just because of the color of our skin. We get denied because of the color of our skin. I am so angered by what happened in Buffalo. But I recognize too that this massacre by firearm has a resemblance to the economic massacre that our leaders and our political leaders are inflicting upon generation after generation of minorities. I've spent many hours on episodes talking to my supporters and to people and saying, sometime in your life, you've got to stand up. And we have a society that's different. We have a society that has recognized from George Floyd and other things that we have the power to stand. I know it's hard when you got to consider that I got to go pick up the kids. I got to get something to eat. I got to go to my second job. I don't have time to sign this. I don't have time to write a letter. I don't have time to join a protest. In some way or form, you got to carve some time out to be part of the movement to unite. To my brothers and sisters who are in those neighborhoods where violence has become the norm. What I have to say to you, certainly can't just overnight change your environment or change your lives. But recognize that what we're doing is exactly what we were conditioned to do, what we were brainwashed to do, what we were coerced to do, not for our benefit. It's time to pick up the fight in a different way. It's time to unite in numbers and say to those who put us in this position, enough is enough. We have gone through situations where we have leaders who have seen white supremacy, who have seen acts done against minorities and have been hesitant to say white supremacy. I remember a few, or maybe a month and a half ago, we had a black gentleman in New York that did some shootings in the subway. I don't think anyone died, but immediately out the gate, it was labeled as terrorism. It's amazing how careful politicians are with their words when you have one black, one white commit the same crime. It's amazing how the label and the rhetoric changes depending on who it is. It takes a lot to be able to have these conversations with you. It takes a lot for me to plead with you to recognize that your time is now to make a difference. Write a letter. Write the same letter, change the date, and keep sending it. Send it to everyone who will listen, and send it to everyone who has power, even if they won't listen. Send them in numbers. Let it be a point where millions of letters each day are. Remember, this is not even costing you anything. You can do it by email. Bring their servers down because they're overloaded with the letters from minorities saying enough is enough. You're going to recognize us as equals, as people. You're going to understand our history. You're going to understand what you did to make sure that we are where we are. And now we're holding you accountable. It is time for a change. It is time for a change. I want to find something real quick before I end here on my phone that I saved because I read it and it struck a chord with me, and I want to see if, here it is. It was something said by Professor Annalise Keating. Racism is built into the DNA of America. And as long as we turn the blind eye to the pain of those suffering under its oppression, we will never escape those origins. That is really powerful. And we need to understand that we all have a role to play. I am playing mine. And I pray that you play yours. So, as I end this episode, I call upon you to recognize who you are. And this is not a call to minorities alone, especially in Generation Z. But I have interviewed on my podcast so many people, white people, who've come from down south and all these places who despise racism, who have come on here and talked about they're themselves being outcast in their own environments because they refuse to see another human being treated the way they have. And them being white, they had to leave their own families because they recognized what their families were doing, how they were speaking about black people, about minorities. And the fact is, something in them wouldn't allow them to accept it anymore. I want to make a difference. I'm going to make a difference. I will put every effort I can in my life to make a difference. As I've said to you before, I believe making a positive impact in this world and in someone else's life is a price that we pay for occupying space on this earth. As we stand united, I pray that we are successful and that those that can orchestrate the difference in Congress, in our governments, are moved, quote, to a call of action. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to know the difference. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I should know that by now. His will, not ours, be done. I hope that you have been impacted, as I have, by what has occurred in our society, and that my words are just empowerment to get you to the finish line. Until the next time, take care of yourselves and each other.